This is an ABC podcast.
When my guest today was growing up in a housing commission house in the suburbs of Brisbane, what he wanted more than anything was a free rugby league tracksuit. It took a while, with a few wrong turns along the way, but eventually Jonathan Thurston got that tracksuit. And a whole lot else. He's won the Dally M Player of the Year medal 4 times, that's a record. He's won the Rugby League World Golden Boot Award 3 times. He's been named Indigenous Halfback of the Century, and he's scored more points in State of Origin than any other player. So perhaps it's simplest just to describe Jonathan Thurston as the greatest NRL player of all time. That's something even a football ignoramus like me can understand. Hi, Jonathan. Welcome to Conversations.
Yeah, no worries. Thank you for having me.
I want you, first off, to take me into a stadium during a big footy game. What's going through your head when you're out there in front of tens of thousands of people about to kick the ball?
So it feels like I'm the only person out on the field. I'm just so focused on the task at hand, whether that be goal kicking or trying to get my team back in the game or trying to close out a game. So I don't really hear the crowd out
you
there.
You don't, if they're screaming or chanting?
Yeah, not at all. So unless we're behind the try line, we had a try scored against us, you can hear the crowd, or you got a conversion from the sideline and you hear the crowd giving you a spray. That's probably the only time I really hear it, but
Does that bug you when you hear that from the crowd?
No, not at all. I'm used to it. Just goes through one ear and out the other, so it's part and parcel of the game.
Are you looking for faces, like your partner or your kids in the crowd?
Yeah, sometimes I am, especially when we're standing doing the national anthem before the game. I'm certainly looking for my family. It's what I'm playing for, my teammates and my family and those that I'm representing. So, yeah, certainly look for them in the crowd.
And when you're lining up a kick, I mean, what's going through your head? Are you telling yourself something?
Yeah, so I've got a process, a routine that I always go through. So when I line the ball up, I stand over the top of the ball and I wiggle my toes so I get a feeling of where I want to strike the ball, and I pick out a target behind the goalpost that I want to aim for, and I take my 5 steps back, my 3 to the left and my 0.5 step back, and then I pick out a target on the ball where I want to strike it. I wiggle my toes again and then I visualise my running and making contact with the ball, and then I follow the line of the ball through the sticks, and then I follow the line back through to where the ball's sitting on the tee. I take a couple of deep breaths, and then I take my run in. I count my steps as I run in, so I take a 0.5 step back, and then I take 1 to the left, and then I count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and that 5th plant is the one that I kick with, and I watch the ball go through the sticks more often than not. So that's my process of goal kicking.
I feel like I've just been given like the secret recipe to KFC or something. I'm going to race home and make it. If I did that, would it work?
I'm not too sure, but that's the process I always go through when I'm kicking.
How did you develop that? Did a coach suggest that to you, or how did
it happen? I've been goal kicking since I've been about 15, probably 13, 14, 15. And as I started getting older, I started getting more strength, so my run-up didn't have to be as long when I was through my junior days. So, yeah, that's what I've had throughout most of my career.
And maybe if you've got that really, that process set in stone, you don't have to think, you don't have to work it out each time. You can just go into that mode.
That's right. You know, always goal kicking after training sessions, and obviously the playing group will be around that you've just finished training with. So when you're goal kicking, you have scenarios. We've just scored in the corner, we're down by 1 point, this is to win the game, and the boys are standing around, they're heckling you and things like that, and that's how you I suppose become better, and you're going through that routine, and while the boys are standing there heckling you, you just block that out and zone it out and go through your process and kick the ball.
I bet they take that as a personal challenge too, to see if they can get the heckle that breaks through your concentration.
Yeah, they do too.
What about like wind or that sort of stuff? Are you taking into consideration the different conditions out on a field?
Yeah, definitely, especially when there's a breeze coming, a headwind or a tailwind with my goal kicking. I've got a right to left hook with it, so the breeze will alter how much swing I get on the ball, if it's a headwind or it's a tailwind. So obviously a tailwind will hold the ball up a bit more, then the headwind will allow for my hook to come around a bit more. So yeah, you take all those into consideration.
And that's all just happening in split seconds, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. So obviously the closer I am to the sideline, the further I take the ball back. So I've got to take all that into consideration. situation as well. So when I'm right on the sideline, it's about 23, 24 metres. I like to take the ball back, but that will alter depending on the breeze.
As you say, more often than not, when you kick, it goes through. But when it misses, what's the feeling?
It depends how big the moment is, really. So obviously if it's early in the game, I just put it in the memory bank from where I had that spot, and then I'll readjust. If we score on that part of the field again, then I can readjust on what I've just done goal kicking wise. So if I scored certain parts of the field and then we score a try there again or thereabouts, then I can judge on the previous kick that I've had in that area that I can adjust and make that on the run.
God, the way you describe it, Jonathan, there's so much strategic thinking, so much calculating when you're playing. It's not just sort of banging into each other, which is what it can look like.
No, definitely not just banging into each other. It's very strategic. And, you know, I found out the older I've got playing rugby league, the game plans that the coaching staff have given us, I've been at one with it and been able to execute those game plans more often than not.
How exhausted are you by the end of a big game?
Yeah, extremely exhausted, especially when you're playing for your country or your state or you're playing finals footy. You know, the intensity goes through the roof, and certainly by the end of it, yeah, you're very tired.
Are you aware of that exhaustion while you're playing, or is it not until the final whistle goes that you kind of let yourself feel how tired you must be?
Yeah, you don't take it into consideration, so you just keep... You know, you just got that task at hand, whatever it is, whether you're defending, whether you've got the ball in hands. You know, you don't listen to the little devil that's on your shoulder telling you to quit or telling you to, you know, you can't do this because your legs are giving in. You know, it's just mind over matter when it gets tough like that.
And when you wake up the next day, how sore? I'm not just talking about the sore head, I mean
yeah. The self-inflicted, but we do a lot of recovery now, processes, so a lot of the ice baths, stretching after games and things like that, the protein shakes and all that to help with recovery. But certainly your body is extremely sore the next day, and I find probably, you know, 2 days later is when it's probably at its most sorest, and it's a little bit harder to get out of bed of the mornings.
Let's go back to Commodore Street in Sunnybank Hills, where you grew up. Did you have your own room?
We shared a lot, whether it was my younger brother or my older brother that used to live with us at the time. So we had bunk beds there.
Did you have your own bunk?
Pretty much first in best dress, but more often than not, I would choose the bottom one, and my younger brother would sleep up top, or my older brother would sleep up top. So, yeah, more often than not, we shared the room.
How big was your family?
So I got an older brother from my mum's previous relationship. I got an older sister from dad's previous relationship, and I got a younger brother from mum and dad, who's 3 years younger than me. So my little brother came along when I was about 3 years of age, but all my childhood memories are from Commodore Street. We lived in Acacia Ridge previously, but yeah, I can't remember being there, so all my memories are from Commodore Street.
Was it a happy house? Did you have friends and family over?
Yeah, yep. So my mum's one of 13. She's got 9 brothers and 3 sisters, so we spend a lot of time with our family over. Had cousins that used to live with us on and off throughout my childhood, so always had people in the family staying with us, whether that be uncle or aunties or cousins. So I wasn't short of someone to play with in the backyard, whether that's cricket or rugby league.
Tell me about your mum. What sort of role did she play in your family?
A massive role. She's the second eldest of the family, the eldest daughter of the family, and she's like the matriarch of the family. She certainly keeps the family together. She's like the glue, and she played a massive role in those early years of shaping me who I am today. So, you know, I wouldn't be where I am without her.
What would she do to you, Jonathan, when you'd done the wrong thing?
Well, back in those days, she has to have this these slippers that she used to wear, and they were cream, and then they had this pink fluffy bit over the top of it, and underneath it was nice and ribbed. And when I was playing up or mucking up, we would certainly cop that across the rear end.
Would she throw it at you, or actually come up close?
No, so she'd grab us by the arm. And, I used to found out a way that I could dodge it so I wouldn't hurt as much. When she'd come to the top of the launch pad, and when she'd come down, I'd move my butt about 2 inches. So the impact of that slipper, I would just miss. And while while, I'd be screaming and carrying on. When I'd get back to the room, I'd tell my brother she missed me. So, but certainly mum was there when we needed a cuddle as well.
So that was the footy dodgers you were learning early on. Yeah. What sort of stuff would you do that led to your mum getting out that floppy slipper?
Back chatting, being, you know, an older brother and you know, being mean to my younger brother in any way possible. So things like that.
What about your dad? What did he do for work when you were a kid?
Yeah, he was a fitter and turner by trade. He spent a lot of time away from home as well, so working away. So dad was always the threat of the house. But, yeah, mum was the disciplinarian. And, yeah, got a lot of great memories from, you know, dad being at home and playing rugby league or cricket in the backyard with us. So, yeah, he played a massive role in my childhood.
How did he get you to start kicking the footy when you were just 4 years old or so?
Yeah, so he played local rugby league in the south side of Brisbane for Acacia Ridge Hotel, and he asked if I wanted to be the ball boy of that team. So that was just, you know, getting the ball back when it was kicked out and placing it back on the sideline. So yeah, that was when I was about 4 or 5 years of age, and I couldn't really care about the football at the time. It was about getting that, you know, 4 or 5 bucks for doing it.
And then, what did you spend that money on?
Red Frogs and video games. So, yeah, as soon as the full-time siren went, I'd be getting the cash off Dad and making sure that I spent it extremely quickly.
What are your first memories then of actually playing footy, of playing with a team?
Yeah, my first memories are playing for South Acacia Ridge. I started there when I was 6 and played there 6, 7 and 8, and then I moved over to South Sunnybank. So my first real memories are playing at South Sunnybank Rugby League Football Club, and, you know, it was barefoot.
Barefoot
back then. It was barefoot until you're under 10s, I think you started wearing boots. So I remember the ground used to be freezing cold, and you used to run as fast as you could to warm them up. So, yeah, most of my childhood memories were playing rugby league or at South Sunnybank.
What skills did you have straight off the bat?
I think my speed back then was probably my biggest skill asset. You know, I scored a lot of tries and didn't make too many tackles, so a bit like my professional career. But my speed was my strength when I was younger, and, you know, I used that to my advantage. So, yeah.
How important was winning to you when you were playing as a kid?
Extremely important. And it didn't matter what I was playing, I wanted to win. And, you know, that's been probably one of my traits and strengths throughout my professional career. But yeah, certainly as a kid, if we lost, there'd be tears and I'd be kicking stones. And yeah, I certainly didn't like losing, and it took me a long time to, I suppose, accept that losing is a part of sport.
What would your mum say to you when you'd be crying after losing a footy game?
She would just comfort me, you know, give me a cuddle and tell me that everything will be okay. But I certainly loved winning than losing.
Does that mean you took training seriously too, even from a young age?
Yeah, I think so. I always wanted to be the best that I can be, no matter what I did, and rugby league was a big part of my life. So, you know, from the junior coaches that were teaching you all these skills assets, I remember, you know, being at South Sunnybank and, you know, the lights would be off and I'd still be kicking the ball out there trying to, you know, master the craft. And, you know, I had a really good mate that I grew up with, Joseph, you know, we'd be doing the same as well. So, you know, trying to hone those skills from a very young age.
So were you dreaming of being a professional footballer right from those early years, do you think?
Yeah, definitely. You know, I didn't have any posters or anything on the wall, anything like that. But yeah, from a very young age, that's all I really wanted to do. And I loved rugby league so much. And, you know, I always had a football with me, whether I was going to school or to footy training, or whether we were just kicking it down at the park, I always had a football.
What was your reaction, Jonathan, when you first saw another kid wearing a Broncos tracksuit?
Yeah, that was probably the toughest part of being a teenager, playing rugby league. You know, the Broncos, Brisbane Broncos, had a massive footprint throughout Brisbane, and going to these carnivals and seeing all these other kids my age, if you were half decent, they'd be wearing their Broncos tracksuits.
What that they would have got from the Broncos.
For scholarships and things like that, yeah. So that was very disheartening, because I always looked at the players that they were signing, and they had it scholarships, and you know, I always thought I was a better footballer than them. But like throughout my teenage years, I always got told that I was, you know, I didn't have the right body type, or I was, couldn't tackle, I was too small, and things like this. So yeah, those Broncos tracksuits, I'm not bitter about it at all, but you can probably tell I am still bitter to this day. But yeah, those Broncos tracksuits, yeah, anyone that was half decent was getting one of those at my age.
Well, I imagine that if you know you're skilled and you're making rep teams like you were as a teenager, and you're playing and practicing so hard, it must have just not made any sense to see other kids getting that tap on the shoulder when you weren't.
Yeah, so it was very disheartening.
Did you ever think of quitting rugby league?
Yeah. I remember when I was a 15-year-old and going down to South Sunnybank to sign up, and I didn't want to sign up because I just didn't think my career was going there. I didn't think I was, you know, my rugby league was going to go anywhere. And I'm very lucky that the president at the time, Adrian Griffin, said to me, if you don't want to play, how about we just sign you up now, so then we don't have to do all the paperwork later if you want to sign up. So that sort of made me sign up, and while I didn't want to play, I ended up playing that year, and we ended up playing pretty well as a team. So yeah, I do remember wanting to not play.
Your teenage years were tough in other ways too. What kind of trouble did you start getting into?
It's something that I'm not proud of, but certainly, with the mates that I was growing up with, there's things that we did that I'm not proud of. So, we would kick a football over the fence and see if anyone was home, and if there was a shed in there, we'd have a look in the shed, and if there was a lawnmower or whippersnipper, we'd come back that night and take that from the shed and we'd sell it to someone. So I'm not proud of those actions, but it is a part of my life. You know, obviously, I'm sure there's other kids out there that are certainly heading down that path, but, there's other things out there that they can certainly do to make themselves better.
Do you remember in those years when you were hanging out with a group of kids doing that stuff, was it scary, or did it feel like, oh, here's my mates and it's kind of fun to do this stuff together? Do you remember what would go through your head when you were, breaking into cars or sheds or whatever?
Yeah, not really. I think it was more of an adrenaline rush. The thought of being caught or someone seeing you and then legging it away from them. So more of an adrenaline rush, but also, we'd be getting money for these items as well. So while I'm not proud of it, it is part of my story.
Were you drinking as a teenager too?
Yes, I was.
Where would you get grog from?
So we used to hang down near one of the bottle shops around from home, and if we seen a young looking person going in his early 20s, we'd call him over and we'd give him money to ask if he can buy us a bottle of rum or a bottle of bourbon, and more often than not they would, and that's when I started drinking, from probably about 13, 14 years of age.
Did that affect your football, drinking and being out at night?
It sure did. Most certainly did. While I didn't drink the night before a football game, more often than not it would be after games that we would do that. So, drinking came pretty early.
When you talk about these years, you drinking, breaking and entering, your life could have so easily gone down a certain path. What happened to change things?
So when I was in year nine, towards the back end of year nine, I got an opportunity to go to St. Mary's College, and I went for the interview, and they had a look at my report card and said, I can't come to school with a report card like that. So they said, we'll have an interview with you in a year's time, and if you can get your grades to a satisfactory level, we'll have another chat. So, Yeah, I went back to the school that I was at and got my grades to a satisfactory level, and I went back to the high school, St Mary's, towards the back end of grade 10. And
why did you want to go there? What was special about that school?
So that was a rugby league school. The Walker brothers had been through there. So
this is up at Toowoomba.
Toowoomba, yeah. So Toowoomba St Mary's College there, and they play in a confraternity shield, which is a big rugby league carnival, and there's a lot of scouts and people that, you know, go to watch these tournaments. So having this opportunity, you know, is something that I really wanted. I've got to thank my Uncle Dean, who's been a big part of my life, and my mum and dad for making that move for me. And I remember the interview went well, and they found me a place to stay, where I stayed with the Seddons in Toowoomba for the first year. I'd go to footy training with their eldest son, and then I'd go to school with their youngest son. So I did that for a year. And
how was it living away from your mum and dad for the first time?
Yeah, it was quite hard at first, but, you know, the Seddons quickly became my family away from home. And the thing about being in Toowoomba, it was only a two-hour drive, so mum and dad and my younger brother would come up and watch me play league on the weekends, and, I'd get to see them fairly regularly, so that certainly helped. But, yeah, the Seddons were a big part of that as well.
What was your social life like in Toowoomba as a teenager?
Yeah, really good. I really enjoyed it. The school was great. The teachers were great. You know, the boys that went there were really good. Obviously, I hung around mostly those footy boys that I gravitated to. And, certainly playing rugby league there and going to school, it was a fun time.
Can you remember what, you know, your best outfit was to wear on a night out in the town at Toowoomba?
I'd have these corduroy pants, and certainly I'd have my school shoes, the black school shoes to go along with it, and I'd wear a button-up t-shirt shirt as well that I thought I looked pretty hot in, but certainly looking back and thinking about now, it's probably not a very good look.
So does that mean you were still drinking and, you know, partying pretty hard?
I think I wouldn't say partying hard, but that was when I started to realise there was a whole new, that was the first time I started thinking about there's 15 other clubs other than just the Broncos, and that's really when I started to, you know, my rugby league started to take off, and that's when I really started to, you know, train a lot harder, become aware of what I was doing on weekends and making sure that I put footy at the forefront, because this was a great opportunity for me to do something with my life, so I didn't want to become another statistic, or certainly want to become throw this opportunity down the drain.
But after you finished high school, there was no NRL deal waiting. What did you do for work straight out of high school?
Yeah, so that was very disheartening. Going to all these state carnivals, playing school footy and club footy, and, you know, you're thinking that you're playing better than these boys that are there with their Broncos tracksuits and things like that, and then being told by scouts that you don't have the right body shape and we don't think you'll make it. So that was very disheartening. And
did you have someone in your ear, Jonathan, saying, oh no, you can do it, or was it just up to you to keep that belief?
Obviously my parents were a big part of that as well, and the people that I lived with, the Seddons, and then I moved out and lived with my coach at the time, which was Rob Wormsley. So, he was a big part of that as well. And, getting all those phone calls and things like that, all those letters, saying that they're going to discontinue talks at the end of high school, that was very disheartening. And another bloke that I played league with at the time, he was working at Coles in the butcher section, and asked me if I wanted to come and work for him, and I had nothing else going for me, so I worked at Coles in the butcher section as a butcher's assistant. And
what did that job involve?
Unloading pallets into the cold room freezer. So I spent a lot of time in that cold room freezer, and it was honestly the worst part of it, being probably 60-65 kilos, all skin and bone. I certainly felt the cold, and being in that freezer, I did not like one bit. So I learned to unload the pallets extremely quickly so I could get out of there.
That must have been pretty dire.
So the pallets would arrive every morning, and then they'd wheel that in, and then you'd unload the pallet, redo the stock the boxes. So spent a lot of time in there.
Did you get covered in blood? Is that what happened?
No. Well, didn't get covered in the blood until I started cleaning. So you'd unload the pallets all morning, and then you'd go out, and that's when you'd start getting covered in blood. So you'd be bringing the meat to the butcher, who, you know, cut it all up, and then you'd be stocking the shelves. And then at the end of the day, I was the one that cleaned the whole shed, so cleaned the whole place. So, yeah.
Did it make you vegetarian?
No.
So working as a butcher's assistant at Coles in Toowoomba, what phone call happened that changed things?
Yes, I had made Queensland 19s as an 18-year-old, and I was I think I was the only uncontracted player in that team. So, yeah, I played pretty well that night, and the next day or a couple of days later, my coach, who I was living with at the time, got a phone call from Nathan Brown, who was doing recruitment for the St. George Illawarra Dragons, and he answered the phone, and Brownie said, you know, this is Nathan Brown, is Jonathan there, can I have a chat to him? And he goes, oh, bull crap, this isn't him, tell me who this is really. So he didn't think it was actually Nathan Brown calling, and then, yeah, finally he put the phone on, and that was my first really interest from a club, was Nathan Brown, who tried to recruit.
How had he heard about you?
So he seen me playing that Queensland 19s game at Lang Park, I think it was back then. So, yeah, he said I played pretty well, and he wanted me to come down and live down there and, you know, become a part of the Dragons setup. But if I was moving to Sydney, my mum wanted me to live closer to my manager, who was Sam Ayoub, and he ended up getting a deal for me with the Bulldogs. So, yeah, I moved down to Canterbury as a 18-year-old, and yeah, things started to happen pretty quickly there.
Did you get your tracksuit?
I finally got my tracksuit, yes, a Bulldogs one. So I remember getting it too, so much gear, pulling it out, taking it out of the plastic wrappers, and yeah, finally I'm starting to realise, you know, my dream. And yeah, I remember being so excited, being able to finally have a tracksuit from an NRL club.
So, Jonathan, you moved to Sydney to play with the Bulldogs. Were you getting paid enough at first just to play footy?
No, so I moved down on a training trial to start with.
So what were you doing to pay your way?
So they found me a job at Pickles Auctions, washing cars. So I'd wake up at about 6:15, walk down to Pickles Auction, which was a suburb away, and then start at 7, wash cars from 7 till 3, and then go and train from 3:30 till about 8 o'clock, and that was how it all started.
How homesick were you?
Yeah, so it wasn't too bad when I first got down there, but certainly a few weeks in, not playing footy, started to miss the family, and I remember, you know, Ricky Stewart found me in the lockers crying, and yeah, you know, he realised that I was homesick, and he said to me, you know, I'll send you home, but you've got to promise me that you'll come back. And I said, yeah, of course, I'll come back, but I had no intentions of coming back. So I went back home, and it was great to see all the family. And I remember when the taxi arrived to take me to the airport, I was in tears, and I didn't want to leave. And Mum pretty much had to kick me in the back of the taxi and send me on my way. But when I got back to Sydney, yeah, I played that weekend, and it all started happening pretty quickly for me.
When you started playing then on the team, what was the biggest difference about an NRL game compared to what you were used to?
The biggest thing that I noticed about playing reserve grade was the strength of the players. They were a lot stronger than what I'd been used to. Yeah, the strength and the speed of the game was something to get used to.
Jonathan, when those massive guys are running towards you, how do you not just run the other way, which must be what every instinct is telling you to do?
Yeah, it's just, I suppose, years and years of practice and getting your tackle technique right. So, you know, not being the biggest person on the field, I used to, you know, sort of always go for the legs and use their force to try and bring them down. So, yeah, just years and years of practicing.
Do you sense the impact of that collision before it hits? Like, are you sort of tensing before you get thwacked?
No, it was just the task at hand. I've been doing this since I was a kid, so it's second nature to, use my shoulder and, bring them down the way that I did. So, yeah, it was just part and parcel of the game.
What was the culture of the team like?
Yeah, so I moved down there in 2001 and then finally got a contract to play 2002.
Did that mean you could leave Pickles?
Yeah, so that means I could leave Pickles and, doing full-time training. So that was a big part of my development, being able to train full-time with the playing group and being exposed to the type of training that they're doing, especially in the gym, where I certainly lacked size and lacked strength, and that was probably my weakness, being able to lift those heavy weights. So being able to be exposed to that type of training certainly helped me, put me in good stead for the years to come. And the Bulldogs were a club that trained harder than anyone else, and if you were mentally weak with your training, they'd weed you out. So I learned from a very early time that training was part and parcel of rugby league, and certainly at that club, there was no club that trained harder than the Bulldogs.
This is Conversations with Sarah Konoski on ABC Radio.
Jonathan, you were describing your start in the NRL playing for the Canterbury Bulldogs, and you said that no team trained harder. Were there any that partied harder than the Bulldogs?
Yeah, that was something that I got used to as well. They were a team that was at the top of their game in those early 2000s. 2002, I think we won 17 in a row. 2003, and especially 2004, a lot of those games the boys were playing in that type were Friday night games, so they'd have the rest of the weekend off, and a lot of the boys would certainly converge to either the eastern suburbs or to Cronulla, and we would spend a lot of time together as a group, and then come Monday morning, it was time to get your work boots on, and no club trained harder than those boys.
Was it fun? Did you like that social world?
I did, yeah, I certainly did. I had finally had my foot in the door playing NRL footy. I made my debut in 2002, so this was finally, my dream was starting to happen now, and this was everything that I'd worked for. These were all the sacrifices that I'd made as a kid, moving away from home as a 16-year-old from your mum and dad, and making the trek to Sydney and things like that. So all the sacrifices and all the hard work, being able to finally get that first NRL contract and certainly playing NRL, my dream was starting to happen now.
What about all that drinking though? Do you reckon, looking back, that was a mistake?
I wouldn't say a mistake. It was part and parcel of the life I was living back then. I can't talk on behalf of other players. I'm only talking on behalf of myself and what I did.
The Bulldogs made the NRL Grand Final in 2004, and you were just 21 and picked to play on the side. What was going through your head when you ran onto the field for that Grand Final?
Yeah, I couldn't believe it. I was 21 years of age, and here I am playing in an NRL Grand Final, because I broke my leg throughout that year. So, I was in and out of the team towards the finals, and, I was playing NRL one week and then dropped the following week playing, and then Steve Price got injured.
He
was the captain, yeah. So he got injured in the prelim final against Penrith, and I remember going in to see Folksy in his office, when he told me that I was going to be playing in an NRL Grand Final, I nearly fell off my chair. so it was quite an experience that week. Being in Belmore, all the flags, everything they were doing, blue and white sausages, and I couldn't believe it. So being able to play in a Grand Final from that age, it was quite an experience.
Did you have to keep your nerves in check? Like, how do you prep your mind for a game of that significance?
I've always been someone that embraces that, so I never felt like nerves were a part of my playing. But, the enormity of it certainly hits when you're in the sheds and you're warming up, and you warm up inside in the shed, so the noise is just magnified 1,000 times more, because, everyone's talking, the sound of the boots, the boys are kicking there. everyone's talking, so the intensity's through the roof, and being a part of that week was something I'll never forget.
What about the moment when you won?
Yeah, it was, I couldn't believe it. Here I was, a 21-year-old, you know, all I'd ever wanted to do as a kid was play rugby league, and I was living out my dream, and 20, 21 years of age, and I'd won an NRL grand final. I couldn't believe it. I thought, this is what rugby league is like, being a part of these moments, but, you know, it wouldn't be till 10 years later that I'd have another moment like that. You know, I remember being up on the stage, on the podium, and getting your NRL grand final ring, and they're all numbered 1 to 17, and because I come off the bench, I was number 18, so there wasn't a grand final ring for me, and the one that they gave me had number 10, which was our captain's number, Stephen Price, who was injured, and when I looked at it, it just didn't feel right in my hands, and Steve Price had a massive influence on me throughout my time at Canterbury, and I gave it to him and said, this one belongs to you, mate. There's no one more deserving than you to have this. And, yeah, we embraced, and we've had a great relationship ever since.
That's a beautiful thing for a 21-year-old to be able to do, Jonathan. Please tell me they gave you your own ring afterwards.
Yeah, so I did get one. We got inside the sheds, and Steve Folks, who was our coach, God rest his soul, he gave me his premiership ring, and then the jeweller ended up making me one. So, yeah, I did get one in the end.
After that win at the premiership, you accepted a contract with the North Queensland Cowboys. What do you remember about arriving in Townsville? What were your first impressions?
How extremely hot it was. I remember when we landed, I was sitting up the back of the plane, so the back door opened, and the heat just filtered straight through the aeroplane, and I'd look outside and you could just see the steam coming off the tarmac, and it was just gross. Like, I was thinking, I remember saying to my manager who was with me, you know, is that South Sydney deal still there, because it seems a little bit
around,
too hot.
Yeah, I know. Around.
So, you know, it was only like 100, maybe 150 metres to get inside, but we were drenched by the time we got inside, and so, it was extremely hot.
How tough is training in those conditions?
Yeah, extremely tough. We had Billy Johnson, who was our trainer at the time, and yeah, there was no person that trained tougher than Billy. All the training that Billy did was all cardio stuff, so it was all, you know, treadmill, rower,
climber. But that would have been air-conditioned in that gym.
No, definitely not. So when Billy arrived, it used to be air-conditioned gyms, but he took out all the luxuries, so there was no fans, there was no aircon, there was no TVs, there was nothing, so it was just a mad sweat box. You know, I'd never seen anyone spew doing gym work until I arrived at the Cowboys. So there was a lot of boys that would be bringing up their lunch after training. So, yeah, it was tough training.
Who would clean that up?
He'd make the boys clean that up, whoever vomited. And I remember one of the boys were doing a rowing session, and he ended up vomiting, and Billy told him to get outside and get some fresh air and come back and grab the rower and clean it. So he's grabbed the rower, he's walked outside and he's hosed it all off, and he's come back inside, and Billy goes, "See, boys, that's what fatigue does to you. It makes you weak. Now grab the rower you spewed on and clean that one." So he ended up cleaning the wrong rower. So
oh, no.
Yeah, so yeah, it was tough.
What,
tough
he was
going.
So dizzy or whatever?
He was so
out
fatigued,
of it.
So, yeah, so dizzy. Grabbed the wrong rower and cleaned the wrong rower. So
one of the many reasons why I'm not an NRL legend such as yourself, Jonathan. Tell me more about how the Cowboys are seen in Townsville. Like, how big a deal is the club up north?
It's not just Townsville, it's North Queensland Cowboys, so we cover a massive footprint, but certainly, you know, I noticed very early on there, the community certainly got behind the team, and, you know, I arrived at the club when they were on the up. They'd made the finals for the first time in 2004, and 2005 was a very big year for myself. I arrived at the club, I made my State of Origin debut that year, I won my first Daily M, so I certainly noticed my stardom, if you could say that, start to, you know, get recognised a lot more. That took a lot of getting used to in the early days.
How did you handle that if you go down to the shops or the movies or whatever in Townsville and people are recognising you?
Yeah, so I was it was tough to deal with first because, you know, I was always a bit of a larrikin and a knockabout bloke. So I used to, you know, enjoy going with the boys, whether that go to the movies or, you know, I would eat out a lot. So it started, just becoming the norm that people would come up and ask for autographs and photos. So getting used to that part of the lifestyle was tough at the beginning, but over time you understand that, you know, that community invests a lot into the North Queensland Cowboys, and you know, you have to give back, and you know, I found that out very early on.
How big a part of being a Cowboy is the rivalry with the Broncos?
Huge. Yeah, I didn't
Why is that?
I think it's because, well, when I first arrived, there was that big brother, little brother scenario, you know. The Broncos, they had it all. They were getting the massive crowds. They, you know, they had the money to spend. They had all the internationals, all this type of stuff. And always it felt like, as a Cowboys, as a club, we were looked down upon from the Broncos. And being able to play in a derby, my first one was 2005, which was my debut for the club, and I know we got pumped that game, but the highlight for me was getting tackled by Darren Lockyer, who was an idol of mine. So there was just as many Cowboys jerseys at Suncorp Stadium than there were Broncos jerseys. So
people travel down from up north,
and that's something that I learnt very quickly on being a part of the Cowboys, is that their fans travel far and wide to watch us play. So, you know, it was quite an honour to represent them.
When you were a kid growing up in Sunnybank Hills, what was Origin Night like?
Yes, we'd all gather around the TV and, we'd be cheering on the Maroons, a massive fan of the Maroons. So, you know, we'd be having barbecues and things like that, or we'd be going to family or friends' houses to watch the game. So, Origin was a big part of our household.
So you first got the call to play Origin in 2005. So you'd already played in a grand final by this stage. How did the atmosphere compare between the grand final and an Origin
totally
game?
Totally different, because it was played at Suncorp Stadium. So my debut game, I can remember it like it was yesterday. It was probably my first big clutch play on the big stage, and we got out to a very early lead. I think maybe it might have been 19-0 at half time, and I remember walking off thinking, you know, Origin's not all that it's cracked up to be. How easy is this? And then probably about 15-20 minutes later, it was 20-19, we were down. So the tables had turned so quickly, and I've never thought that about Origin ever again. And the atmosphere, you know, when you run out onto Suncorp Stadium and that maroon jersey, it's honestly the best ever feeling you can get. It's the sound, it's just deafening, and it doesn't stop. So, I've got a lot of great memories from that.
In 2010, the first Indigenous All-Stars versus the NRL All-Stars game was held, and Dr. Chris Sara, the Aboriginal education campaigner, he got all you Indigenous All-Stars together. What did he ask you when he got you together in a room?
Yeah, so that was that exercise was a very pivotal time in my life. While I'd always known that I was Aboriginal, he said to the whole group, he said, if you know much about your family history and culture, stand at this end of the room, and if you don't know much, you know, stand at that end of the room. And so while I always knew, I didn't know too much about our family history and where Mum had come from, so I was at that end of the room. And after that exercise, I remember ringing Mum and saying, look, I want to find out more about our family history. And she said, you know, that's men's business, so you need to ring your Uncle Marky. And I rang Uncle Marky and a couple of me uncles, my grandfather, and about a dozen of me cousins. We got a minivan and we drove out to Mitchell, where Mum is from. And
that's Western Queensland.
That's Western Queensland, out past Roma. So we drove out there, spent the weekend out there doing traditional dancing. Markle showed me the local watering holes where they used to swim and things like that, and where they went to school and where they grew up. And it was the piece that was really missing in my life, I think, because I remember calling mum the next day and I was saying, you know, I feel like I've been here before. It just had such a calming influence on me. And mum said, yeah, you have as a baby. I can't remember being there, but yeah, I just felt like I'd been there before and it just had such a calming influence on me. And, you know, to be able to spend the weekend there with family that I hadn't met that, you know, played a massive role in my mum's upbringing and my uncle's and auntie's upbringing is, yeah, well, I remember walking away from there when we were leaving, and that's when I, you know, really decided that I wanted to do something with my life and I suppose do something more with our culture.
The other thing that was happening in your life off the field at this point was that you and your partner Sam were trying to have a baby. How tough was that journey?
Yeah, that was extremely tough. You know, we'd been trying for a while, and to know, you know, we just had no luck. We decided to go through the IVF part, and we had, you know, three or four unsuccessful attempts there. So it was a good, you know, couple of years of failure, you know, watching your wife do the daily injections and all that type of stuff, and, you know, watching the roller coaster of emotions that she's going through, and this is all happening to her body. And while, you know, I'm being as supportive as I can, you can't really fathom the way that they're feeling. And we decided to go to Sydney to try, and our first attempt was unsuccessful. And I remember, you know, Samantha saying to me that you should be with someone that can give you a family, and that was quite heartbreaking that she was starting to think that way, because we were both in love with each other, and whether we could have kids or not, you know, I wanted to be with her. And yeah, so we said, how about we can go through another attempt and we'll see how we go. And yeah, the next attempt, Frankie Louise come along, and yeah, she's a bundle of joy, and she's a miracle.
What was the drive home from the hospital with little Frankie like?
Oh, I've never driven so slow in my life, having this precious cargo in the back of the car. And while the lights are green, you're still looking left and right, making sure no cars are coming through. And yeah, it was normally takes about 10 minutes from the hospital to get there. It took us about half an hour to get home. So yeah, it was certainly a slow drive.
Frankie has got two little sisters, and now you're having baby number four.
Yeah, so Charlie Grace is our second child, and yeah, Lily Rose is our third, and yeah, we're expecting another child at end of February. So our first three were IVF babies, and this one is natural. So I don't know how that happened, but yeah, the one time it does, it happens. And I remember walking in into the house, and Samantha was standing there crying, and thought something was wrong, and she ended up, you know, pulling the pregnancy test out from behind her back. And I was like, no way, how has this happened? No. So yeah, it took us a while to process what is happening. And you know, given her age, she wasn't too keen on going through it, so we had to go through counseling to make sure that we're both on the same page of what we wanted out of life and what we wanted. And yeah, I'm glad we'd gone down that path, and now we're both over the moon that we're going to have another one at the end of February.
In terms of football, Jonathan, I guess in one sense your career culminated with the 2015 NRL Grand Final. It's a game of highs and lows. So I'm just going to let us hear a little bit of the low first.
And Jonathan Thurston's walking away on his own. He's taken the headgear off. He's walking backwards. And he's thinking about probably the biggest moment in his whole career, everything that he's ever done, the hours of practice, the time spent alone, kicking goals in the park, hour after hour, and despite being exhausted, he's got to kick one from the touchline to win his team a premiership.
Let's stop and listen to the crowd. Kennedy. It looks to me as Oz taking the steelwork. This is a horror movie.
This is a horror movie. It's still a horror movie when I hear that.
How hard is that to listen to?
It's quite difficult to listen to because, this was my time to shine. You know, I'd dreamt of this moment all my life. This was it. You know, this was my chance to end the game there. And I swear, as a goal kicker, you just know when you hit it flush that it's going through the sticks, and I could have put my house on it when it came off my boot. It just felt flush. It felt pure as a goal kicker, and I'm glad I didn't put my house on it because I'd be homeless now. But you don't have to be a lip reader to when you're watching the vision to see how it affected me.
Do you have nightmares about that kick, or do you just move on? Like you do it, it stuffs up, and you move on.
Yeah, so I've learned to put that behind me, put big moments, disappointments behind me. And while I was very disappointed about the goal kick, I remember all the boys coming over and patting me on the back going, "Don't worry, we'll get it an extra time, we'll get it an extra time." And I had to, you know, switch my focus straight away from disappointment to what's about to happen.
Well, I think it is only fair that we hear the high as well from this game.
Thank you.
12 metres out in front. Thurston to choose from, which coat. He hits it.
What about that moment?
We can play it again if you like. I can never get sick of hearing that. No doubt it's my greatest memory on a rugby league field is being a part of the first ever premiership winning side of the Cowboys. And, just the whole circumstances of how it all unfolded is something I'll never forget.
A couple of years later, 2017, your season ended when you injured your shoulder. What did that do to you emotionally, having your season end like that?
It was probably the toughest time I've had in my career. I was sitting on 299 NRL games. This was my final appearance, game three. You know, I just wanted two games and I would have been happy with that. And, I get back to Townsville after that Origin and the club send me to get the scans. And I get the scans and I go straight to the physio. And there was a few of the boys and a bit of coaching staff in there as well. And he asked them to leave the room and give us a bit of privacy. So I started to think, oh, this doesn't sound good. And he looked at me and said, "It's not good." And I said, "Oh, what do you mean it's not good? You know, I've played injured before. We can just needle it. And, I've got two games. Give me my 300, you know, for what I've done for the club over the years. And then, you know, let me play this final Origin. That's me done and dusted. You know, I'm happy with that." And he goes, "I can't let you do it. Your shoulder's it's gone." And I said, "Come on, we can play it. Like, I can play injured. Just give me the needles." And he said, "You won't be able to pick your kids up if you do more damage to it." That's when it hit me. Yeah, I remember there was just total silence and I didn't say anything else to him and I just walked out. Yeah, I jumped in the car and it's about a 25-minute ride from the stadium to home and I rang Samantha and she said hello and I just sat there in silence and drove home. And
couldn't even speak to her.
Yeah, couldn't even speak to her. And she just sat on the other end of the line until I got home. And I was an emotional wreck. Tears were flowing. And, you know, I remember the girls running towards me and giving me a big hug and a cuddle and a kiss. And I remember Frankie saying, "You know, it'll be okay, Daddy." And, it was quite an emotional time having to go in and get your shoulder reconstructed.
But that didn't end. You played, you signed for 2018.
Yeah, I did. So come back from a shoulder reconstruction and I remember getting out of hospital and I remember the surgeon saying to me that it's probably one of the worst shoulders I've seen. It's the typical type of a car accident.
What drove you to go back? Why not finish then?
I thought I had, you know, more to offer. I didn't want that to be how I'd finish my career. And, a lot of hard work, a lot of, you know, hours and hours of rehab work, prehab work, getting my shoulder back to a strength. And, to be able to finally get back out on the paddock and wear that Cowboys jersey, you know, one more time and have the final year there, it's something that I'll never forget.
What's it like not to be playing the game and training for the game that was such a huge part of your life since you were 13?
I drove past the other day. It was in the afternoon, past the sports reserve, and I was like, said to the wife, she was in the car, I was like, the boys are training. And she was like, how do you feel? I'm like, yeah, I don't know. I feel okay. I feel all right. Like, it's, you know, my time's done and dusted. I'm at ease with what I've been able to achieve. And I said, I feel okay for the moment. So it was very hot that afternoon too. So I was like, yeah, I'm glad I'm actually not out there sweating it out with them. But, yeah, like you said, rugby league's been a big part of my life. And I'm in a fortunate enough position where I'll be able to stay involved in the game. And, yeah, you know, I won't really know until the rugby league season starts again what emotions will be running through me. But, yeah, I'm in a fortunate position where I'll be able to stay involved in the game.
If you were to talk to a young player, maybe in a similar situation to yours back when you were a kid, is there any advice you'd give them, Jonathan, that you didn't get?
I think the one sort of regret I do have sort of in life is I didn't apply myself to my schooling the way that I did my rugby league. And I remember when school had finished and when I got all those letters saying that clubs will discontinue talks with me. Now I was just like, I'm working in this butcher shop. I'm like, started to think, why didn't I apply myself to my schooling the way that I did my rugby league? And that's probably the advice that I'd give now is apply yourself to your schooling, because, you know, the career of an NRL player is 40 games. You know, I've been blessed and lucky to play in a lot of games, but yeah, not many get there. And you need something to fall back on and put the blinkers on and work extremely hard, whether that be your schooling or your career, no matter what sport that is, you know, work extremely hard.
I reckon your mum would be happy with that advice.
Yeah.
Jonathan, it's just been great to meet you. Thank you so much for coming into Conversations.
Yeah, no worries. Thank you for having me.
And the memoir written with James Phelps is called Jonathan Thurston, The Autobiography. Jonathan's doing a series of events right around the country, An Evening with JT, and we'll put the details up on our website, abc.net.au/conversations. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.